It's time for the Talk of Gasoline Alley, featuring the historian of the world's greatest race, the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's our friend Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Hello, Donald.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Good. We've got a question from afternoon host JMV coming up a little later on.
Okay.
But we're going to get right into it with our telephone calls in a moment. Oh, you know what? I did promise we're going to start off the show with. Let's talk about what's going to happen at the IMS Museum on Tuesday night, the 23rd.
Yeah, 2 weeks from tonight. Something that I'm looking forward to very much that I always thought I'd like to do, and the opportunity has just materialized at the Speedway Museum as part of the speaker series now. And in conjunction with Emmis, I believe, there will be... it's the 25th anniversary of the close finish in 1992 between Allanser Jr. and Scott Goodyear, and both of them will be in a meeting area that's now been developed in the back of the museum, and I have the honor of moderating the two of them, and we may have a couple of other guests, but those two will sit, and I guess we'll all sit between the two of them. I don't know how we'll do that, and we'll just reminisce about the 1992 finish, and if we have time, maybe get into a few other things, but that's going to be the main thing.
That'll be cool. Allanser Jr. and Scott Goodyear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Donald Davidson. And the IMS Museum.
I think they've done it something like this a couple of other times over the years, but evidently not with great frequency, because when we approached Scott Goodyear back in, I think, January or something, he said, and we said it's the 25th anniversary, he said, "It is? You're kidding." So he hadn't even realized it. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to sit with those two fellows and hear what they have to say. And if they bounce off each other, that'll be great too.
Ticket information is available at 1070thefan.com.
If you go to the events tab on 1070thefan.com or WIBC's website, it's right there, and you can buy your tickets from the website.
Okay. Do you know how much tickets are?
About $95.
Okay.
And that gets you free food, gets you into the event, I think a private tour of the museum, door prizes.
This is not going to be 3,000 people, so you're going to have good access going on, and that's actually a pretty good rate because you're talking corporate events like that. Any type of event at a place like the IMS Museum, you're normally talking $200 for a table and that kind of thing. So this is going to be very good. So we look forward to that coming up on Tuesday the 23rd. So there's your hint that that's probably one of our email nights, unless we can clone Donald. So live telephone calls tonight at 317-239-1070. We still have lines available. We start with James in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, James.
Hi, James.
Oh, Donald, yes, it's Jay in St. Paul.
Oh, Jay, right? Yes, okay, yes. Sure.
Okay. Yep. And wanted to know about, I always look for drivers you haven't talked about. Well, okay. How about Tony Willman?
Oh, Tony Willman was from Milwaukee and actually was at the Speedway in 1931 to potentially drive for Frank Briscoe. And a lot of people will say, well, wait a minute, he didn't come to there till 37, but he did. He was on the entry list as the potential relief driver, and whether he took any laps at all, I don't know. Things were different back then. They didn't have the rookie test, but anyway, 1937 through 41, so it was a very brief career. And in 1937, he started out with a Duray special, Leon Duray. And there was some shuffling during practice. There was the four-wheel drive car, which was a Wisconsin car. It was the four-wheel drive auto company. And they were in, is that Clintonville, I think, Wisconsin? Anyway, the four-wheel drive special had been driven in 33 and 34 by Frank Briscoe, and then 35 and 36 by Maury Rose. And several people were in it in 37, including Floyd Roberts briefly. But then Tony Willman qualified that one. Then in 1938, driving for Bellinger, one of Merle Bellinger's early entries, he dropped out of that one. But he did drive relief for Harry McQuinn in another Milwaukee car. the Marchese Brothers special. Or apparently some members have gone back to calling themselves Marchese, which is actually the correct pronunciation. But for all the Milwaukee fans that used to go to the Milwaukee Mile in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was the Marchese Brothers. Anyway, Harry McQuinn finished seventh, and Tony Woman drove laps in relief. In 39, he did not finish. In 40, he actually got bumped. And I remember that when I did that record for somebody, Frank Briscoe, who was a crusty gentleman and lived in Chicago, but was actually a Wisconsin in fact, his name was not Briscoe, but Brushka. And so anyway, he had old world temperament. And when I was doing the Tony Woman record and the fact that in 1940 he drove the leader card special and qualified and got bumped, Mr. Briscoe went around and said I didn't know what I was talking about, that Tony Woman never missed a show anywhere, and you know, he'd either put it on the pole or crash it or whatever. And I thought, well, okay, I'm not going to be able to change your mind, but it's in the records. He qualified and got bumped, and then actually did drive relief in that one as well. Babe Stapp driving the Cerber special. Actually, the car was qualified by Shorty Cantlin, and Shorty Cantlin was not able to drive on race morning, and for reasons that officially are a mystery, but unofficially, let's just say he had a good time the night before and was not in condition. In fact, I'll probably tell him tales out of school here, but and I'll come back to that. But anyway, Babe Stapp had not qualified for the race, and so he took over the car that Shorty Cantlin had qualified, and Tony Woman was a relief driver. That one didn't finish either. And then 1941 was the final start with the Lyons special owned by George Lyons, and again a DNF. And then Tony Woman was fatally injured that October in a midget race at Thompson, Connecticut, I think. Boy, I hadn't thought about this for a while. I'm going to have to brush up on this stuff. But anyway, back to the tale. Shorty Cantlin apparently was, he owned a bar, but I don't know whether he, and it's funny, I was thinking about him driving down here because I came down 16th Street and took a good look at the same pothole that that Kurt discovered the hard way. But anyway, once in a while I'll do these little detours, and when you're coming down 16th Street, just before you go over the bridge, there's a little park on the right hand side. When you're getting very, very close to Methodist Hospital, just before you go up the hill, there is a building that it's still the same building, but it's got a new front. But that was Shorty Cantlin's bar in there. And when I was first around it, it still had a race car outside, and the front was the same. I wish I'd paid more attention to it then. But anyway, so I'm not sure that Shorty Cantlin had that bar at that time. But on race morning, apparently, he was trying to recover by drinking 7-Up. And Henry Banks told me, he said, I came around the corner on race morning. Henry had not qualified, but he was standing by as a relief driver for a couple of different people. And he said, I came through the garage here, and here's Shorty Cantlin saying, what do you think, Henry? Do you think he could take it? And so why he declined, I'm not clear on that. But anyway, Babe Stapp took it. So probably didn't need to tell that story, but all of these 17ths and 24ths and 33rds, I like to throw in some some colorful anecdotes about these people.
Good question, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry in Frankfort, Kentucky is next with Donald Davidson. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
How you guys doing tonight?
Very good. Thank you.
My question, it's kind of obscure. I don't know there was a Lexington car company that entered the 500 in the first few years of the race.
Yes.
What could you possibly tell us about them?
All right. Well, actually, it's funny you'd mention that because Lexington was from Connersville, moved to Indianapolis, but it started in Connersville. And we were just over there today talking about Lexington. We did a talk. And anyway, so I just thought about a follow-up on Tony Willman. He had a son named Gene who did not drive, but it was a very prominent USAC midget car owner in the 1960s. And Bill Engelhart drove for Tony Willman. And actually, Larry Rice a few times did also. But anyway, Lexington started in Connersville. And I'm not very good on car histories, but this is a company that was started by the Anstead brothers. And there was, I think, a Frank. And anyway, that if the name Anstead sounds familiar and you're thinking of Bill Anstead, who was the owner of the Anstead Rotary Special, Pat O'Connor, and then later the Sheraton Thompson Specials with Shirley Murphy, who was a man, and A.J. Foyt. Bill Anstead was the son of one of the brothers, and I think that Frank might have been his uncle. But so anyway, Bill Anstead was raised in that environment. I'm not sure how long Lexington lasted. A little longer than a lot of those early day automobile companies, but their one entry in the 500 it was in 1912, when still virtually all of the cars were passenger cars mm-hmm. that were being entered by the companies for the purpose of showing the public how good the automobiles were. And the specialized racing car had already made an appearance in the form of the Marmon Wash, but the Lexington actually was a stripped-down passenger car, and Harry Knight drove that in the 1912 500 and was an early out. That's the only time they entered.
All right. Thank you for the question, Jerry. More of your calls for Donald coming up. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Talk of Gasoline Alley continues on 107.5, 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is here to answer your questions. Full phone lines when someone drops off. That's your cue to call in tonight. We do phone calls, but if, say, you happen to be a sponsor of the host's son's racing team, then you go to the front of the line. And Jennifer has sent in a picture. That's a cool picture, and asking if Donald knows anything about it. So I'll let you to describe who is in the picture, and then we'll see if we know anything.
Okay, I don't know how exciting it is to describe a photograph over the air, but we're looking at J.C. Agajanian, Dwayne Carter, Walt Faulkner, and Clay Smith. And Dwayne Carter has his arm around Faulkner's shoulder, which is easily done because Faulkner was only about 5'6", 5'7", in height. And I'm assuming this is after qualifications in 1950. It wasn't clear that it was the Indianapolis Speedway, but there's a gentleman in the background that appears to be wearing a badge. And Faulkner won the pole with a 1-4-lap track records in 50. And then also was the fastest qualifier, but not on the pole, in 51, with the same combination of Clay Smith as chief mechanic, J.C. Agajanian as the owner. And I can only think that Dwayne Carter is there because he drove Agajanian's sprint car. But anyway, radio fans, I hope this was an exciting bit of radio for you, me describing a photograph. I've not seen that one before. It's a little bit different, and that's probably about the best I can do.
Cool picture. All right, back to the telephones. And I think it's our first chance to visit with Paul from Racine this month. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Paul.
Hi, Donald. Hi, Kevin. Good to talk to you today.
Thank you. You too.
Wonderful. Yes, thank you. Donald, we all know what happened 40 years ago this month. It was historic on a couple different levels. But I also, before I do that, can I just share a little story?
Please.
We talked about Bobby Marshman last night.
Okay, yes.
And one of the gentlemen, you probably know him, who lives up in Fort Wayne, is helping to write that book that Michael started. And he befriended Bobby Marshman's sister. And they went to his family took her to the 1998 Indy 500.
Oh.
And can you understand what the irony there is?
No, I can't. I didn't know Bobby Marshman's sister came to the track. I talked to his wife not too many years ago, but maybe 3 or 4 years ago. But no, I don't know about the sister coming.
Yeah, so she came, to my understanding, that one time. And the car number that won was the same car number that he had.
Oh, number 51. Oh, I never thought about that.
I thought
of a couple of Bobby Marshman things. I always, some of my best answers are driving home. And I thought that in trying to talk about his personality and the fact that he was so polished, and I said, you know, he would have been a Penske driver, no question in my mind. I know that he liked to read. And that he was not overly fond of horseplay, and that if they were at Springfield or DuQuoin or something like that, and there was frolicking going on and people were ending up in the swimming pool, he would distance himself a little bit because he would prefer to read. And then the other thing is that he and his wife, Janet, they had a boy, Robbie, who grew up, and I don't know what he's doing now, but probably 25, 30 years ago when I was still at USAC, if you can get around this, Bobby Marshman's son was living in Japan as a teacher and teaching Russian to Japanese kids, and he was an American. So not too many of those around. And I met Robbie. I knew Bobby Marshman, and I met Robbie, and he looked quite a bit like his dad. And I don't know what he's doing now. But no, I didn't know about the sister coming to the track, never thought about the number 51 connection.
And it's my understanding that you went that one time, and that was it. But I wanted to talk to you about, you know, what happened 40 years ago this month, and obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is A.J. Foyt's fourth win.
Uh-huh.
But also, this was the year that Janet Guthrie qualified for her first 500.
Yes.
And I would like you to talk a little bit about that. I actually was in an antique store last fall and found a copy of her book that was signed, and I obviously couldn't pass that up. So, but just some of the players: Rolla Ballstead, Dick Simon, Jim Nakamura, I believe she mentions in the book, and I understand she had a bit of a feud with Pat Patrick. At least she talks a little bit about that in the book.
Haven't read the book, and I don't know quite what that would be, but. If you want me to just address 77 only?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Well, just the dynamics of that event.
Well, you mean from her point of view or from all of it? Because there was there were a lot of firsts and a lot of special things that happened in 77. So,
I was just thinking more along the lines of Janet's odyssey to get to be the first woman to qualify for the 500, Kay Bignotti having to start the car, just kind of her month of May and all the dynamics.
Kay Bignotti did not have to start but I know where we're going with this. Janet had been there in 76 for Volstead with an older Volstead-built car, and they'd had problems with it. She passed the rookie test and didn't make a qualifying attempt. And then on the Saturday eve, and I'm talking 76 now, on the Saturday eve of the third qualifying day, they agreed, we're done. We've used up all the equipment. We don't have any engines, and so we're done. And so the following day, then really dramatic was the fact that she came out still a little bit of a mystery. And she drove a few laps in an A.J. Foyt backup. In fact, it carried number one which was Foyt's earned number, but he preferred to go with 14. So there's a car sitting there with one on it. And so she came out on the last morning. I remember that on Sunday morning because we used to do the first day from out there up in the Turn 2 Suites. And I remember that hearing that we think Janet Guthrie's going to drive for Foyt. What? Well, she went into the garage last night. They shut the door, and they're in there for a while. We think she's being fitted for a car. So anyway, she comes out, and I remember that she did five laps. And from a very, very slow warm-up, which they were doing in those days, she built up to speed. Then the yellow came out. I'll go back to that. And this is 76 rather than 77. And then she came out and after the yellow, which was for actually it was Jim Herdebeest with the front engine car, the Mallard. And I think that I'm not saying he blew an engine, but something happened in which, you know, there was some liquid went on the track. And so everybody had to come in and wait while the track was cleared up. And it didn't take very long, as I recall. And then she went out and took five more laps, and each one was progressively quicker. And I think that Jim Phillippe actually was doing the commentary because Tom Carnegie hadn't come out yet, and I might be wrong on that, but I remember that it was quite exciting because each lap was better and better. And then when she finished the 10th lap, which was the fifth in the second segment, she came in and she was running very close to what qualifying speed would be. So we thought, well, she'll be out later and qualify for Foyt. And that was it. She never came out the rest of the day. So that's still a mystery to this day about what was going on. But there's just a little tangent off of a tangent here that because it was Herdebeest, nickname Herc, H-E-R-K, was short for Hercules. And Hercules, because he was immensely strong, was shortened to just Herc, and it was H-E-R-K. And so Foyt, for whatever reason, had allowed this to happen. So he's out in the pit area in civvies, I'm assuming, and Frankie Delroy was the old riding mechanic turned chief mechanic and now the technical chairman. And so he's on the headset, and so when the yellow came on, and Foyt says, what's the yellow for, Frankie? And Frankie said, it's Herc. And Foyt thought that he had said, it's her. And so he had to be consoled. And then, here comes Janet rolling in. So anyway, that was it for 76. So she comes back. And
we're going to have to take a break. Yeah. All right, then. Okay. We're going to take a break to get to the next year. All right, stay with us. More to come with Donald Davidson on 107.5 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Back to your calls in just a moment, but we continue talking about Janet Guthrie, and we move to 1977.
I do have a question about the David Deering found in the archives, that Sid Collins piece with the early days and Carl Fisher. There's not a writing credit on that, is there?
I will look.
Did you recognize it? You wrote it?
I did. I think I wrote that.
What is that from?
Oh, I don't remember.
We played this on Trackside the last hour.
Years ago. I mean, Sid's been gone 40 years. So anyway, back on Janet Guthrie, she comes back in 77. And all of those years for Brian Heating and Cooling Specials, Phil Hedback, it wasn't the factory that was sponsoring the car. It was Phil Hedback, who was a local dealer. And he was always trying to get Bryant to spend more money because he said, look what we're doing. I'm just a local dealer. If we spent more money, you know, we could have one of the top teams. And so I think that they took an interest in Janet. And I think there might have been some factory money involved. So they got a Lightning. Mm-hmm. And that's what she drove in 77. And she did not she did not get in the first weekend. And then she did have an accident, and I don't think it was, would be a major shunt, although easy for me to say, watching the replays. But she did hit the wall coming out of turn two right in front of the suites on a practice day. And I think that one of the marks of how serious is somebody about wanting to qualify, if they can come back from that, which she did. And then she did not qualify on the Saturday, and I don't recall if she made an attempt or not. I think she only made one attempt. I'm a little hazy on that, but what I do know is that she qualified on the last day, and I think she was 18th overall. And not only was she the fastest qualifier on the last day, she was the fastest qualifier of the last weekend. And again, I think her speed ranking was something like 18th. So there was much celebration, and unfortunately, the race was a disappointment for her. There was a mechanical problem very early in the race, so she got 29th and probably deserved much better. And then the comment about Pat Patrick, I'm not sure if this might tie in, but the car that she drove the following year, which was a Texaco Star in 1978, she ended up finishing ninth, and that was the highest finish by a woman until Danica Patrick came along in 2005. But anyway, that car was a Patrick Wildcat, and it was purchased by Shirley Murphy, who was the Bill Anstead partner with the Foyt cars, and he hadn't been around for a while. And I was never clear why that happened, it was Janet Guthrie Racing Enterprises, I think, was the entrant. But Shirley Murphy had purchased the car from Patrick and then turned it over to her. So whatever, not having read the book yet, and she did write that herself, by the way. That's another thing. There was no ghostwriter or editor with that. Janet wrote that herself. And I imagine that it would be a superb read, and one of these days, we'll get around to reading that.
And we can probably finish up really quickly. Sure. on starting the car. That had to do with what Tony Holman was going to say.
That was the thing, and I don't know why that was such a big deal, but everybody was up in arms because it had always been, gentlemen, start your engines, and oh, what are we going to do now? You know, the world's coming to an end because we're going to have to change it. What are we going to do? And I thought, it's pretty simple. Lady and gentlemen, start your engines. And when we came to the track that morning, I remember, we're all gathering around where the network office was in those days underneath the grandstands, and they still didn't know. And then so finally, through Luke Walton, they came up with what I thought was a very awkward thing, where he said something like, in company with the first lady ever to qualify at Indianapolis, or something like that.
Yeah, that's
comma,
it.
Gentlemen, start your engines. So anyway, when it came up, they said, somebody said, why don't they just say, gentlemen, start your engines, because the driver doesn't start the engine. It's the person around the back with the inertia starter. And so apparently Kay Bignotti, who was Louis Meyer's daughter and married to George Bignotti at the time and had nothing to do, with the Bignotti teams, but she said, well, I'll fix that. I'll start it, and I'll be a woman starting, and then they'll have to address that fact. So I don't even know whether she did it or not, but I remember that coming up, and I'm thinking, what a tempest in a teapot. And then that was Tony Holman's last year. And so the following year, when Mrs. Holman, Mary Fendrick Holman, did it, she did a much more straightforward, lady and gentlemen, start your engines, which is what I think Tony should have done in the beginning. But anyway, there we are.
All right, let's move on and check in with Jeffrey in Tipton, Indiana. Hi, Jeffrey, you're up with Donald.
Hello, Jeffrey. I remember Tipton. There was a race driver from there by the name of Danny Day who never started in the race, but co-drove the car that finished 10th in 1934, the Lucchetti or Lucchetti Special. I have that pronounced. But anyway, that's what I always think of when I think about Tipton. But that's not what you're asking.
Hi, Donald. It's a pleasure and my honor to speak with you.
Thank you, sir.
And it's not the month of May until I hear Gasoline Alley.
Okay, thank you.
No, thank you. My inquiry is about Ed Elysian.
Yes?
I recall some scuttlebutt about his braggadociousness of leading the first lap at the 500, and then he supposedly, from what I understand, caused the crash that...
Okay, I think that was overblown. There's several things that are really interesting about the fact that they had that speed battle going with Alesian and Dick Rathman back and forth, and that they would vie for the honors of being the fastest in practice, which I think. I don't know that it was worth anything unless it was like free dinner at somebody's restaurant or something like that. But anyway, Alesian idolized Bill Vukovic, who now was no longer living, and Vukovic's apparent style was just lead every lap that you can until it blows up, and Alesian tried to model himself after Vukovic, it is said, and he'd never had a really good car. And A.J. Watson, for whatever reason, I actually asked Watson a couple of times about Alesian to find out what his, because he just seemed to support him so much. And he just said, well, he stood on the gas, and that's all I could get Watson to say. But anyway, so I think that Alesian apparently had a gambling problem. And he was into several of the other drivers and other people associated with racing and owed money. And so he saw now the opportunity that he could have one good day and be able to pay everybody back. So he almost won the pole. I'm going to use the term erratic, but I don't mean that he was all over the place. But the lap times and speeds were not as tight as some of the others, and he actually came away with the one lap track record, and Dick Rathman was able to knock Alesian off the pole, but he had the four lap record, and so they came out. It was pretty unusual. One guy had the four lap record, and a different guy had the one lap record. And so, anyway, there was a very confused start, and I don't want to go into all of that right now. But they came down for the start. They went around on an extra lap, which apparently confused a lot of people. And I used up too much time talking on the previous answer, so I'm just trying to tighten this one up. So it comes to pass that Dick Rathman takes the start at the lead by a fairly decent margin over Ed Alesian, and then everybody is way behind. And so they go through turns one and two and then down the back stretch, and Alesian apparently was, he had the bit between his teeth. And he thought, mm-hmm. I'll lead as many laps as I can and do what Vukovic used to do. I'll have a good day and pay everybody back. So he goes underneath, he passes on the inside, going into turn three. And as he's going through turn three, the film footage shows that the car gets sideways. And instead of going all the way around in one fell swoop, it goes sideways, and it looks like he's going to catch it. And then at the last moment, then he, completes the loop. Now, Dick Rathman is sitting behind him and doesn't quite know what to do. And the rule of the racetrack was that if a car spins in front of you, you aim straight for it. The theory being that when you get there, it won't be. And it doesn't work every time. And so he decided to try and go around Alesian to the right, and Alesian just collected them, and then the two of them went up and hit the wall, Alesian going tail first and Dick Rathman going head first, and then this terrible accident that ensued behind them that ended up with Pat O'Connor, who was extremely popular and a favorite to win the race, in fact, and he lost his life. So I could go on at great length about the ramification in the days that follow. But anyway, the theory is that whenever Alesian had gone out, whenever he qualified or when he went out on each night, between 5:30 and 6, and Dick Rathman and Alesian would go out alternately and try to have the unofficial fastest lap of the day, they're running a light load. And so they're ready for the race now. And Alesian has a full tank of fuel, which would be 75 gallons. I think that I don't know if they could go larger than that, but it's at least 75 gallons. And so the theory is that he, when he went through the turn, rather than it being a, I don't know if you'd call it an error of judgment on the driver's part, because he went into the turn as hard as he had been all month. And apparently there are those that think he had not taken into consideration the weight of all of that fuel, and that's what caught him out. And so anyway, he was again, I could go on forever about him. I when people ask me, who did you not meet that you would like to have? I would like to have met Alesian. I mean, he's not my number one, but I would put him on my list of if I could have, you know, 8, 10, 12 people. I'd like to have at least, if not met him, I'd like to have seen him, mm-hmm. and you know, see if I could figure out what he was about, because everybody said he was just a little bit of a mystery. And there's a kind of a cult favorite. I mean, there's a number of people that are just fascinated by him. And so anytime that I've talked to somebody, said, did you know Alicia? And they said, well, no, but, you know, I saw him. And I said, well, you know, tell me, what was your take? And he just was sort of kind of a loner and a bit of a mystery.
Mm. Jeffrey, thank you for the question. More with Donald coming up, 107.5 1070 The Fan.
I renamed the IRL to IndyCar. That was me.
That was Gene Simmons of Kiss, Donald, who was guest with JMV yesterday. And John wanted me to ask you. He asked me about this, and he said, well, no, that's not correct. It had been known as IndyCar well before 2005 or 2007, whenever Gene Simmons and his marketing group was involved. Now, it is possible that his group encouraged them to start emphasizing the IndyCar moniker again. But the question is, when and how did IndyCar come into vogue referencing the cars that race at the Indianapolis 500 and the cars that race on the USAC championship circuits?
Well,
And I told him you wouldn't really care for this question.
I'm not really, no. In fact, I've got, you know, number one, I want to thank Gene Simmons for all the fantastic contribution that he made to the sport. But that when it was over, did he come back? No. Did he ever come as a visitor? No. But that's okay.
Well, he will if you pay him again.
Probably.
Yes.
Yeah, probably. I met him, and I was surprised how tall he was. He was very tall. But anyway, the term IndyCar, and a lot of people won't want to hear this answer. When I came to the area in the mid-1960s, very few people used that term, Indy 500. And I know that it's in the lyrics of Fun, Fun, Fun by the Beach Boys, which was 1963, I think. And but even so, the locals didn't call it that. And so people told me at the time, they said, no, San Franciscans do not like the term Frisco. That apparently that irked them at that time. And then surprisingly, I knew somebody who lived in Las Vegas, and they said they don't like Vegas. And it was Richard Petty, not Dick Petty. And it was David Pearson, not Dave Pearson, and Indy 500 just wasn't what you would call it. And so in 1971, which was the first year that ABC did the tape-delayed telecast, and we had a breakfast, the network, radio network, we had a breakfast, and it was the old Stouffer's, right behind WIBC on North Illinois, 2835 North Illinois, and you go through the parking lot to Stouffer's. So we were up on, whatever floor it was, and Tony Holman would normally come, and it was a working breakfast. And Tony would normally just say a few words and, you know, thank you, boys, and leave or whatever. And so he said, I do have something I would like to say. And it was very unusual for Tony Holman to make a stand of any kind. And he said, we just, with all of the attention now with the TV and everything like that, and he said, there's a lot of attention on us. And he said, we started to notice that the term indie is being used more and more. And I'm paraphrasing what he said, but essentially it was that we think that Indianapolis has a more prestigious sound to it. And so I'd really appreciate you boys on the air if you would refer to it as the Indianapolis 500. And I thought, that's good enough for me, and I'm still doing that. And so as the years went by, Indy became used more and more and more, and it started to catch on. And people that came in that were new, for want of a better term, would hear it being used, and then just felt that... That should be adopted. And then eventually it became, you'd see it more and more in print and now in official terms. So you have to call it IndyCar because that's the name of the product now. But it's still, honestly, it bothers me a little bit. And I refer to it as the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500 at every opportunity I get. And I remember, actually, Lynn St. James qualifying one year. I don't remember what it was. And she's on the PA, and she referred to it as the Indianapolis 500 in her post-qualification interview. And I thanked her later. I said, thank you for calling it that, because some of us really feel that should be. But anyway, I suppose, you have to go back and give credit to everybody that's done notable things, and by golly, Gene Simmons is on the Mount Rushmore of activities at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Okay, so when did they start calling the series IndyCars?
When did they first start to call them IndyCars?
They were Champ Cars.
Well, yeah, I mean, I called them. I still call them Champ Cars. I mean, it people would refer to it as the Speedway.
I've heard old clips of Paul Page from the 70s, or man, it might have been the 80s on television, talking about in today the Indy Cars race in Long Beach.
Well, kind of thing. I mean, you could it was becoming more and more common, but I remember that. You'd call it the Speedway. Some people called them Speedway cars.
Yeah.
I called them Champ cars because it was short for National Championship cars.
Mm-hmm.
But then people would call it the Indy 500. You would hear a lot. But the worst of the lot was when they would refer to it as the Indy. That's the one that hurt the most. But when it first started to be used officially... Well, because IRL, I mean, that was the Indy Racing League.
That's was the PPG IndyCar World Series before then. The IRL. Yeah. So it obviously predated 1996.
Oh, but that's before Gene Simmons. That can't be possible. They must. They how could you steal something retroactively? I don't know what I'm talking about here.
All right, but, we'll leave it at that.
Anyway, there's a few things that have happened that I wish wouldn't have happened, and but they never. But here I'll use my line that I've been using for a while now. When it happens at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, it's forever. It never goes away.
And you have to answer the questions about
it. Yes, forever. Yes.
Thank you, Donald. We'll do it again tomorrow night
at
8 o'clock. Thanks to David Dehring. We'll have the podcast up. 1070 The Fan, pass this along to your friends. Tweeted out instructions today of the different ways to download podcasts. I retweeted that. You can find it at KevinLee23 because, frankly, I don't know how it works, but it does, and the smart people got it done for us. Thanks to David. For Donald, I'm Kevin. Trackside tomorrow night at 7 as well here on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.